I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. Well, I'm going to be talking about training. Is that too loud? Is that okay? Training to be oneself and the acceptance of the self and being content with one's own training, which has been a koan for me over the years. And I'd like to share with you some of my own experiences with this. And also, I've got lots of good material here. I'm going to be quoting from Roar of the Tigress, Volume 1, which you've all seen, and the unpublished Roar of the Tigress, Volume 2, which I've had the privilege to look at, but you haven't. And it's Reverend Master Jiyu's talks on the Shobo Genzo, which they're quite wonderful, and I've read them all, I'm proofing them, and I'm also helping to prepare them for publication. So hopefully they'll be available in the spring. Well, this will give you some idea of what they're going to be like. It's said that there are those people who have sudden understanding, sudden awakenings, and it's like turning on a light bulb full suddenly. And there are those who have are more like a dimmer switch. And that what is truly important is the training, whichever way your training is going. Some of us also take several steps backwards and stop for a while. For those of us who are somewhat slow, being content and doing one's training are very important teachings to remember. When you want to know the truth, the unborn, enlightenment, peace, whatever it is you are looking for, whatever's brought you here, you can't actually try to get it. You have to do the training in faith and trust that it will lead you where you wish to go. And this is not always easy if you are brought up in such a way that you mistrust or you think you don't have much faith or you're cynical. However, the unborn is very compassionate, and if we keep on going, we are always given what we need. And I have found this to be true, even at the darkest times. Somehow something helps you out if you are willing to just keep on going. And I've had to learn this lesson of just doing my training and not trying to grab after something over and over again. And one aspect of my own koan is comparing my training to others. And this would often arise very strongly after one of our week-long monastic retreats where you're, you know, working very hard and it's very intense. And even when the retreat would go well for me, during the abbot's Dharma ceremony where all the monks ask the abbot a spiritual question, I would go into deep despair because the koan would arise for me, everybody's doing so well and I'm doing so badly. This is a real theme for me. And one time, this was a few years ago, it came on so strongly and it lasted several months. And I was also very angry and thought, what's the point of doing this if I never get anywhere? And this went on and on and on. And finally one day, I just sat there and I thought, I can't hold on to this suffering any longer. It's just too painful. And I just have to accept where I am and just get on with it again. And so that time it took about 3 months and I finally just let it go and just got back to training. Well, I have seen since then that it hasn't lasted as long. This theme does come up, but I'm more able to just sit with it now. Or if it comes up, let it go more quickly. Because once we see the suffering, And we know that we can let it go. Why hold on to it longer than is necessary? So, sometimes when it does come up these days, I say to myself, be very careful. You know, you want to be angry, you want to act from these feelings, and they will only lead to suffering. So don't believe it. So I have this kind of thing going on in my head, and that helps me just stay still amid something that is very strong for me. Another example of this in my own training was during the Silent Abbot's Dharma ceremony that occurred during the week of funeral ceremonies for River Master Daizui this spring. And during this ceremony, which we also did for River Master Jiyu when she died, all the monks, and during this ceremony, River Master Daizui's lay disciples also went up. And you go up in reverse seniority order, and you just ask a question in silence. And while I was sitting there, I looked at the rows of all the monks, and I saw all these masters, and the whole thing came up again. I'm doing so terrible, and everybody's doing so well. And as I went up to ask my questions, the answer that came back was, be content. And what a wonderful teaching that is. I immediately relaxed and just accepted myself for where I was and who I am. And this is what we all need to do. We need to do the training to the best of our ability, but we have to accept how we are. We're not like that person over there who can do such and such, but we are who we are, and we train to the best of the of our own ability. And there's a wonderful teaching of this in the Zen teachings of Homeless Kodo, which it just so happens that Reverend Kodo told me about. The Zen teaching of Homeless Kodo is in it, Uchiyama Roshi, who was a disciple, a close disciple of Sawaki Kodo Roshi, talks of his teachings. And Sawaki Kodo Roshi was one of the greatest Zen masters of that time, perhaps the greatest Zen master. And he was the one that River Master Jiyu was sent to in The Wild White Goose by Koho Zenji to have her understanding confirmed. And I'm just going to read a few things. One is from the preface, where Uchiyama Roshi is talking about Sawaki Kodo. Sawaki Roshi was like an ancient Zen master, fearless and unconventional. I, on the contrary, am such a faint-hearted person that I hesitate to tell people that I was Sawaki Roshi's disciple. Yet I practiced with him and served him as his closest disciple longer than anyone. When he was very near the end of his life, I asked him, "Do you think I'll be able to lead people after your death?" He replied, "In our tradition, Zazen is the center. As long as you continue doing Zazen, you can lead people." He gave me the encouragement I needed and showed me the direction that I should take. I received this as his final teaching. Then at the back of the book, under a section titled Zazen is Good for Nothing, he says, "Shortly after I began to practice with Sawaki Roshi, I had an opportunity to walk with him in the town of Utsunomiya. While we were walking, I said, 'As you know, I'm a rather incompetent person, but I want to continue to practice Zazen with you for 20 or even 30 years, or until you die. If I do that, would it be possible for a weak person like me to become a little stronger?' Sawaki Roshi replied, 'No, Zazen is useless.' He had a loud, deep voice, was powerful and resolute. 'I am not like this because of my practice of Zazen,' he continued. 'I was like this before I began to practice. Zazen doesn't change a person. Zazen is useless.' When I heard these words, I thought to myself, 'Although Sawaki Roshi said it wouldn't be possible, still I'll be able to improve myself.' I followed him for 25 years until he passed away. Sawaki Roshi passed away on December 1965. While he was alive, I somehow relied on him. After he died, I couldn't do that anymore. Just after his death, I recalled the question I asked during our walk in Utsunomiya and asked myself the question, have I changed after practicing Zazen with the Roshi for 25 years? I realized that I hadn't really changed at all. In that moment, it was natural for me to say to myself, a violet blossoms as a violet, a rose blossoms as a rose. There are people like Sawaki Roshi who resemble huge rose blossoms. There are other people like me who resemble pretty violet blossoms. Which is better? It's not a relevant question. I should blossom wholeheartedly, just as I am. Now, when he says Zazen is useless, I'd like to give my opinion on that. I think, you know, people do change in very fundamental ways, and they transform themselves. But you don't become what you aren't. You become who you are, and you learn to accept who you are. You don't... you are always a human being, and you have to accept that you are a human being. And I found for myself when I first, I'm going to do the terrible thing, I'm going to skip around and confuse myself. But I found when I, before I came to the Abbey, when I was very young, I didn't want to be myself. I wanted to be someone else. I was suffering so deeply, and I disliked myself so much that I really wished that I was someone else. And then as when I came here, see, that's what happens. Now I forgot what I was going to say. Well, when I came here, I was, you know, I was looking for what we're all looking for, peace of heart, compassion, the unborn, whatever we call it. But I didn't want to look at the self. I still couldn't accept myself. And through the training and the years of training that I have done, what I have found is that somehow the training helps us to accept ourselves. Within our meditation, we are sometimes shown that the unborn accepts us completely. And I have found this, that on occasion I have known this, that I am accepted by the unborn. And that what seems to matter so much really doesn't matter. And that the only thing that is important is taking refuge in the unborn. And yet at other times, there is the self that doesn't accept. And I had a really interesting experience of this when I did a retreat a number of years ago. And I was doing a retreat in my room, and I had a rat called Maxwell. And I was feeling, I was seeing the self and judging the self and feeling pretty low. And I looked over at my rat, and he was looking at me with pure love. And for those of you who've had rats, they somehow seem to emanate that kind of pure love. And it really heartened me. And I went over to the founder shrine behind the altar here, and I just opened my hands, and suddenly something shifted, and I was embraced, and the karma was embraced. And all night long, there was this embracing of the karma and the letting go of the karma. And I thought, boy, that's it, you know, this is great. And I was really surprised the next day when there was the judging self. I just couldn't understand it. And I have since learned that this, I don't know if it works this way for all of you, but it seems to work this way for me, is something positive happens and I think this is it. And then there's a self back again. And so the training has to be, even though we are embraced by the unborn, we're totally accepted by the unborn, we have to learn to let, we have to learn to accept ourselves. And when the judgment comes up, we are the ones who have to just let it go. And we have to let it go every time it comes up. And we are the ones who decide how long we continue our suffering. And so now I'm going to try and find my place here and see if I can make some sense of my notes. Okay. In this culture, I think most of us are taught to judge ourselves. It seems to be just the way it is. And from all the people I've talked to, there is such a tendency to judge ourselves and to judge others. And we know very well the meaning of guilt, of the word guilt. Whereas in some other cultures, they don't even have the word guilt in their vocabulary. We have ideas of what we should be like, how we should be. And it's very difficult for us to accept how we are. Now the notes don't make sense anymore now that I skipped ahead of them. I'll skip that one. Well, here's an example of the importance of trusting in the unborn and not giving too much emphasis to the self that's arising. It was in another Dharma talk that I gave in the Buddha Hall. It was the second time I gave a Dharma talk. And I really wanted to just trust in the unborn and let whatever flowed out of me flow out. So I didn't prepare very much. And when I got here, I came here and I sat down and nothing came, for those of you who remember that Dharma talk. And I was terribly frightened, and it was like the worst thing that could have happened to me had just happened, freezing in front of everyone. And so I started talking about fear, and that seemed to go okay. And then I thought, well, when I leave here, I'm just going to never be able to face anyone again. You know, this is the worst humiliation of my life, and that's that. And something really came through to me, and it was knowing the unborn is more important than worrying about feelings like humiliation. And so I passed that teaching along. But we can get the teaching, and yet we have to be the ones who put it into practice. And we have to just keep remembering these teachings and keep trying to put them into practice. Reverend Master Jiyu talks about the importance of not judging yourself in Roar of the Tigress. This is Volume 1. It's terribly important that a person should truly have faith in the unborn at the time of death, because if they do, then they are not going to judge themselves. But some people still judge themselves. No, no, I've done too much. There's nothing I can do. Do you know Marlowe's Faust? Have you ever seen Marlowe's Faust? Very interesting. At the very end, as Faust is going down to hell, the angels are exhorting him, "Look up, look up. You don't need to go down there." And he says, "I'm damned, I'm damned. I have to go." So he goes. And the angels are saying, "He's mad. What's he doing this for?" But he is the one that turned away. And Mephistopheles, in that particular version, is equally beautiful in that when he is asked, what is it like to be in hell, he says, to be in hell is to cut off from God by one's own will, the willingness to cut oneself off. And what is it that cuts ourselves off is just our judgments of ourselves. This is one of the big dangers of coming out of a Christian Judeo background, because you feel you've got to be judged because of guilt. Buddhism says, no, you weren't guilty by being born in the first place. All you did was just pick up some karma. So what are you judging yourself for now? Since you weren't guilty in the first place, why do you need to be judged later on? But if you don't clean up the karma, yes, then you're going to come back again, or something will come back again. Keep on cleaning the stuff up. Buddhism's very beautiful in that sense, quite totally different, but it all comes out of not having original sin. And if you work on your training and work on cleaning up your karma, then it makes it a lot easier not to judge yourself. But you still don't need to judge yourself, no matter how many mistakes you make. And this was a question that was asked of me at the last introductory retreat, is, well, what if you just keep doing the same thing over and over again? How can you stop judging yourself in that case? And I can't remember what my answer was, but you still have to let go. You still have to let go of the judgments. You don't know necessarily why you keep doing it again. What is the difficulty? What thing in your karma is making it so difficult for you not to stop making the same mistake? You have to be kind to yourself and just keep on going. Because if you just keep on going and keep on trying, you will be given the help that you need. Now, when we accept others completely, we can see what it has an effect on them, just as when others accept us completely, you know, what effect it has on us. And if you can stand another rat story, this is my other rat, Edwina. She was my first rat, and she was kind of crazy, and she was wild and frightened, and I didn't know how to deal with her, and I didn't do a very good job. And I was doing another retreat. I did a lot of retreats in my early days. I was doing another retreat in my room, and there was a lot of fear arising in me, and I was trying to just sit with it. And suddenly something arose that said, accept the fear. And for the first time in my life, I accepted the fear in me. And when I looked at my rat, I accepted the fear in her. And suddenly she just melted. And she just was very loving for the first time, and it was just really neat to see that just the acceptance of her, what it did to her. And if you see that, you see what the acceptance of yourself will do for you. No matter how many times people accept us, we have to be the ones who accept ourselves. And I read a story in a book about children having near-death experiences. And there was one story that really struck me about a little girl, she must have been about 10, who tried to commit suicide. And she did this by rolling her, little wheelbarrow really hard down a hill into a tree. And she did have she almost died, and she had a near-death experience where the unborn, or whatever you want to call it, embraced her and embraced her in this love that she'd never known before, and told her, you need to go back. And she said, why should I go back? Nobody cares about me. And he said, you have to care about yourself. And so she went back, and she immediately tried to kill herself again. But she was again embraced by this loving presence, and she then accepted it. And Then she spent the rest of her life trying to be very caring herself. So how do we do this thing of accepting ourselves? Well, I personally think that it's the going on and never giving up and accepting the help that is offered through the teaching of others and through what arises in our meditation. Not being stubborn when teaching is given to us through our own meditation and through others, but accepting it with gratitude and putting it into practice and just going on and going on. And everything, I think, is eventually resolved if we just keep going, just keep trying to do the best we can. Don't think that it is easy to accept our own humanity. Again, from Roar the Tigress, Reverend Master Jiyu says, "And do not suffer from the notion that Zen training will make you anything other than a human being. Accepting our own humanity is one of the hardest tests of all acceptance." So it's not an easy thing, and yet we are already accepted and embraced by the unborn. At another Abbot's Dharma ceremony with, when I was young in training, with Reverend Master Jiyu, in the early days, during these Abbot's Dharma ceremonies, I used to be so scared that I could almost barely not walk up there. And I would just have a question memorized, and I would say it over and over and over to myself, again and again, so that when I got up there, I could just say it. And I almost wasn't even there when I was saying it. I was just reciting this memorized thing. And then one time, during a Dharma ceremony, I felt this fear, but I somehow was able to just stay open. And I went up there, and I said to Reverend Master, "I'm bringing this fear with me to the altar to be embraced." And she said, "It already is embraced." And I knew that it was. But again, then the self came back. Okay. I think I've read somewhere, and I couldn't find it, that Reverend Master Jiyu said that most people lift the veil of self when they start to meditate and very quickly put it back down again. And that gradually over time, they lift it more and more, or perhaps it's lifted more and more for them to look as your faith grows. When you don't believe that what is within you is acceptable, then you are continuously fighting against sitting still with it. And this is how I was when I first started. But I gradually changed. And I'm still working on it, but it's a gradual changing. If you're continually fighting against what's within you, you will always look outside yourself and try to do what I did, which is try to find the unborn by bypassing the self. But it is the willingness to look at the self with kindness and acceptance that allows us to sit still and not react in habitual ways every time the buttons of our koan are being pressed. And by doing this, we are able to more and more cleanse the karma by allowing it to be seen and not acting from it. And to know the unborn. By accepting the self, we can come to know the unborn. As I said before, the unborn already accepts us as we are right now, And we can know this through our own experience, as I mentioned. And I'm going to read something else from Roar of the Tigress, Volume 1. Don't waste time thinking about what God is like. Whatever you imagine that it is, I assure you it is not what you'll, how can I say this? I was going to say, is not what you'll know when you get self out of the way. That's not strictly true. What it comes down to is this. We always place upon ourselves our own personal concept of God or the eternal, something that is much better than us. But we usually stop short at something that just is there and is such perfect love it can tolerate everybody in the world. I don't know if you ever saw that really great old comedy, The Night They Raided Minsky's. There was a lovely line in there where the old Jewish vaudevillian is speaking to the dour Amish father of one of his girls, and they both decide to pray together because, as one of them points out, only a God that could tolerate me could possibly tolerate you. Now you have to keep this in mind. How can you imagine something that doesn't just love, it is unquestioning love? It makes the rain of compassion to fall on the evil and the good. What is evil? What is good? They are concepts in our minds. It is all right for us to have these concepts, as long as we don't try to put them on the eternal. You cannot be judgmental. The most important thing for a Buddhist is not to judge other people. In other words, love God, do your own training. Love the cosmic Buddha, do your own training. Love Allah, do your own training. Don't worry about other people. And then from Where the Tigress, Volume 2, in the chapter called The Training of a Bodhisattva, Reverend Master Jiyu says, the old question of why a just God maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust, is stupid. If one understands Kanzion, one understands that which is pure love and pure compassion. That cannot discriminate between the just and the unjust. It is pure compassion. It is pure love. Here there is no such thing as judging rightness. There is only non-discrimination. For love is love, and compassion is compassion. Mahaprajna, Mahakaruna, the two great pillars of the Mahayana, great wisdom and great compassion. They do not worry as to what a man or woman was. All they do is pour their benefits on all equally. And the way we can work on judgments is just pretty straightforward. For me, is just every time a judgment comes up, is just to let it go and to do it over and over and over again. And this includes the judgments of ourselves and the judgments of others. And I have noticed for myself that there's a moment when I have a choice, when something someone's doing or saying or just their pure existence is bothering me. And and the thought arises. And you have the choice right then and there to let that thought go. And or you can churn it all up and go on and on and on about it and create incredible suffering and judgments. And actually, when we judge other people, we harm ourselves. We continue the hardness of the self. When we can start letting go of judgments of both ourselves and others, we soften and we allow ourselves to become closer to the unborn. So let go of your suffering when you can. When you want to be mean to yourself, be kind instead. It is also a kindness to let things arise when you can and not turn away from yourself. And never, ever give up on yourself or others. Manjusri, you know, we've all seen statues or pictures of Manjusri sitting on the beast of self. And the self is, the Manjusri is keeping an eye on the self, because we always have to, but he also loves the self. And this is what we need to work on. Now, accepting ourselves does not mean that we become complacent. Acceptance of fear doesn't mean that we use it as a reason why we can't meditate and train. Thinking we're inadequate, we don't want to use that as an excuse. It may mean that some things are more difficult for us than others, but maybe some things are easier for us than others. We just don't know. But we always have to keep trying and not use, whilst accepting and loving the self, we also have to train with it. We can train with however we are, and we can be compassionate to ourselves along the way. And each person is truly doing the best they can. I've always heard River Master Jiyu say this, but when I did a retreat a number of years ago, I really knew this, that everybody was doing the best they could. And sorry this is going on so long. Usually I thought it was going to be 20 minutes, so I guess it's better to be longer than Shivani. This is from another chapter of Roar 2. Because your training may seem extremely slow, do not doubt that training is actually taking place, for in reality it is more swift than the wind. Moving on, and it's talking about the moving on of the mountains. Dogen is talking about this. Moving on in this context means doing real training. Constantly moving on means that there is unending training, which is how the training of Buddhas is, and how our training must be. While the training moves on more swiftly than the wind, those who have no familiarity with it have no cognizance of this. Their ignorance of this movement is a very different thing from the fact that those who live on the mountain, those who are the mountain, are in the same situation as the plum blossom that does not know that it is red, and yet still leads the way onward to the truth. For when one flower blossoms, spring exists everywhere. And Dogen says, do not slander the mountains by saying, verdant mountains are incapable of moving on. And verdant, I looked it up, means green or unripe in experience or judgment. And then Reverend Master Jiyu says, the fact that you cannot see a person training all the time does not mean that the person isn't training. We should understand the flow of the mountain. At all times, unless there is a temporary serious blockage, training continues. And of course, there's a tendency to say, well, of course, I have a temporary serious blockage. But we will skip that tendency for now. Because of the shallow views of some persons, there is often doubt about the flowing of the mountains, and often a slander of those mountains. Slandering the training of others is a very serious matter. Our shallow views are due to our understanding being inadequate, and we are amazed to hear the expression that all mountains flow. However slowly a person may seem to train, there is training going on, for the unborn is the unborn, and Buddha nature is at work in every one of us. If we look at our fellow trainees as mountains, knowing how solid and unchanging a mountain may appear to us and yet be in motion, then we can cease to criticize them. We can cease criticizing the speed of their training or our own. A mountain as we picture it is very solid, very still, and yet it is constantly moving. Spring, summer, autumn, winter. Through the brightness of the green of spring to the red of autumn and the white of winter, it remains solid yet moves and flows. Its whole essence moves and flows. It is doing its training perfectly as itself. So are we. No one has the right to judge or criticize the training of another. Well, can you take any more? This is, in this chapter, which I'm continuing with, the practice of mountains and rivers, the mountains are those who are training, and the water or the rivers is the unborn. And in this part, it's talking about the water. Water is simply water, totally detached and complete in itself. Although water may be celestial or terrestrial, and may come in all different shapes and sizes of ponds and oceans, they are all water. The essence of water, Buddha nature, is within all water. Each one of us looks different, male, female, short, tall, fat, thin. But we possess Buddha nature. Look without discrimination, without analysis. Do not say, but it's only a small pond, or worse, but it's a dirty pond, or worse still, but it's a stagnant pond. Pond is pond, dirty, stagnant, or clear. Pond is pond, and it has the watery essence thereof. Even if, like the Potomac, you could throw a match and it would ignite, it's still a river, right? All of our pollution cannot destroy its essence of water. Once we got self out of the way, we see the unborn in all things. This is because we already possess enlightenment. In other words, we are already in the fluid state. As I understand it, the sludge that inhibits the flow of the water within us is our past karma, which plugs up the pipes and stops the flow from going. But the more we clean up the karma, the more the flow is able to move. And as this gets further and further cleaned up, so we become more and more fluid. When the water of the Spirit flows both forth freely, we cannot hold it in our hand, but we may hold our hand in the water, and whilst feeling it, not own it. Therefore, we can experience the water of the Spirit. We can experience the flow of Uji. We can experience the flowering of the Dharma. We can experience the turning of the wheel. All of these are aspects of the same thing, the experiencing for certain of Buddha nature within ourselves. Well, I'm just going to read it all. And we are helped along the way by what River Master Jiu calls the trickle of the ocean in the great ocean of meditation. And what is it that causes us to feel badly when we make a mistake, but a trickle of the ocean, and as she talks about in this chapter. In my early days here, I had a lot of doubts, and I found, and this isn't necessarily good teaching, but I found when I made a mistake or went against my Buddha nature, something in me did care, and it actually strengthened my faith. And I'm not suggesting you make mistakes, but when we make mistakes, sometimes we become aware of that which in ourselves does not want to make the mistakes. And this is what she calls the trickle of the ocean. And because I really like this, the way she talks about it, I'm going to make you listen to one more thing. And in the paragraph that goes before what Reverend Master is talking about, Dogen is talking about the catalysts that lead to realization. Here he is referring to the various things that cause us to reach this state, the catalyst for realization, so to speak. If I were asked to say what was the one thing that caused more people to come to realization than any other, I would say it was the teaching of perceptual truth. We hear of all the koans and how stones hit bamboo, how somebody stubs his toe, etc., etc. You hear all of this, but what was it that set the thing going in the first place, so that suddenly something could act as a catalyst? There is a verse in the Shushogi which says, "Whenever these precepts are truly accepted, Buddhahood is reached. From these precepts come forth such a wind and fire that all are driven into enlightenment." That verse was the catalyst that projected me into the third Kensho. But what would have happened if I had not been studying the 10 precepts themselves in detail prior to that? The verse could not have been a catalyst. It would have had no meaning. What caused me to take up this detailed studying of the precepts at that point in my life? The fact that I was up to certain things, that something in me kept saying, "You shouldn't do that." What was it in me that kept saying you shouldn't do that, other than a trickle of the great ocean of meditation? Buddha begets Buddha in more ways than one. The catalyst is only a catalyst. It's a stone hitting a bamboo or a toe that gets stubbed. And this suddenly sort of jolts something off the shelf, or lines up a bunch of poles in one line, or whatever way you like to look at it. But it is that tiny little voice, that tiny little drop of the great ocean samadhi, which gets the thing going. Through all the many twists and turns that enlightenment uses to find itself within our lives, these are, each and every one, its trickles. You know how on a muddy road out there you sometimes see a tiny little trickle of water coming down, and just that tiny little spot is not dust or mud, and everything around it seems to dry up quickly. But yet that little trickle of water somehow still keeps running. That's how this is. Because we are honestly trying to train, a little trickle from the great ocean of meditation runs throughout one's life. By looking at it from the back end, as it were, after realization has taken place, you can see where the trickle has been. Any time there is a trickle, and you see the possibility of going deeper in your training, of taking meditation and the precepts more fully into yourselves, go with it, because this is what eventually creates a situation in which all conditions are ripe for a catalyst to do its work. It is going with the trickle that makes this happen. Do not go around looking for more and better catalysts. Any catalyst will do when all conditions are ripe. Appearance and disappearance, arising and vanishing, are but dreams. They are but phenomena in time as we think of it. They are nothing more than that. The real essence has no time. The great ocean just is, which is why it is in a state of meditation, and why it does not get upset by all our twists and turns and twiddles, and why it cannot be bound by the sorts of moral codes that we put upon ourselves. We cannot conceive of a moral code so high that it can encompass the entire universe and yet tolerate the twists and turns of each and every one of us. But that is just what the essence of the precepts, which is the essence of the great ocean of meditation, is. And as I was saying earlier, as we train, we let go of the hardness of the self, the judgments towards ourselves and others. And as a result of doing this, River Master Jiyu talks about what the results of doing this are. And this is the last quote. The monk Dokai of Mount Dayo, in instructing his assembly, said, "The verdant mountains are constantly moving on, and the stone maiden in the dark of night gives birth to her child." Master Dogen next speaks of a time when a mountain gives rise to the child of a mountain, when the stone of a stone woman is broken and she gives forth a child of the Lord. Then the Buddhas and ancestors appear before our eyes. They emerge into this world. They come forth from mountains and stones, and stones cry out in joy. For all stones of self must give birth to the child of the Lord. All stones seem still and cold. When first a person sets his or her mind to training, the mind is hard and set and cannot be broken, as it says in the ordination ceremony. For we are as the stone man or the stone woman. But when endless training has softened the self and turned it from cold stone to fire and thence to water, to the cool water of the Spirit, then we give birth to the child of the Lord and can understand how it is that the stone maiden dances and the mountains flow. That was my favorite quote. So thank you very much for your patience.